The wonders of the world around us occur as often as a ripe cantaloupe being sliced near a random breakfast table on any given Sunday morning. You may not realize that this marvelous whack of the machete, or a lesser kitchen implement, ordered from a sleazy television commercial, goes down somewhere around you, perhaps next door, perhaps it's that thwack on the floor just above you. But, believe you me, brother, it does happen. And because such a violent, perfunctory act is taken for granted, it's a great pleasure to know that novelists like Xavier Calvo exist to draw greater attention to the unseen knife that makes everyday life that much larger. Okay, so I am here with the writer and translator of Wonderful World, both Xavier Calvo, who is the writer, and Mary Faye Leatham, who is the translator. Xavier and Mary Faye, how are you doing?
Fine, thanks for having us.
First off, let's go ahead and start with a general question here. You have a unique situation in that you have a translator in-house, Xavier, and I'm curious as to how this translating author situation came about. Was it the fact that she was there that was more helpful, or was it the fact that, you know, having read your translation of Pandora and the Congo, which is very idiomatic, that this was a little bit more necessary from a translation standpoint for Xavier's book? Maybe you can both talk about this unique situation.
I'll start because I think that you have more to say about this. I think that if I remember correctly, I had thought of her as a translator for, as a potential translator for my book before the book even was bought by an American publisher, but I think that the suggestion that she did it came from somebody else. I think it was the agency who just decided that she would be a good translator. So it was our idea to do it, you know, but eventually it came from somebody else.
Yeah, well, it was sort of a dream come true when they told us that this book had been bought to be published in America, because it's not many foreign writers get published here in America. So, and I had just given birth to our first child and was still in the kind of afterglow. So it all seemed pretty surreal. But when Chavi's agent called us, it was, you know, kind of a fait accompli. So of course I was happy to do it, and it posed some interesting, I don't think that actually really posed many challenges, but it definitely had some benefits having the author right there at home.
Yeah, I'm wondering if it was a situation where you called out into the next room when you were in the process of translating, and I'm curious also about specific word choices. For example, nambly-pambly is a frequent modifier throughout this, and I'm curious why that was, whether this may have been a scenario in which perhaps there were three other words that worked better as nambly-pambly in English. Little grammatical and idiomatic choices like that, I'm curious how that worked.
Actually, was surprisingly similar to the way I usually work. I didn't bother him with everything. You know, I kind of try to keep turning pages and get a decent draft going before I deal with certain niggling questions. Like, namby-pamby was a choice, that I made. Because in the end, that was something that became clear. I was a translator and I had the final word. So I certainly consulted him about things, you know, and he was helpful in, you know, adding nuance to something, you know, and obviously when you look up a word in the dictionary, there's often six different meanings. So you have to kind of try and get inside the author's head to think which of those meanings was he most thinking of. And when you have him there, you can just sometimes ask him, and that's very helpful.
And yet, if we go to the source material, or at least the translated source material, there's an emphasis on bigness, Xavier, in your book, that is bigness and largeness. And particularly, I have to ask you about the frequent large asses. I mean, everybody seems to have a large ass. There's the fact that people are constantly sprawled out in their chairs. They can't quite fit into their particular chairs. And there's this emphasis from with largeness, almost from the very beginning, with the giant multi-story cake. And everything becomes larger and larger and larger. So this nuance that you're talking about, Mary Faye, I'm curious as to how this worked in tandem with this, with Xavier, your concern for just largeness or gargantuan, the gargantuan descriptions, the gargantuan world and all this. Maybe you could talk about how the subtleties of giganticism actually came into play here.
Well, there is certain elements in the plot of the book that I think can be mistaken for obsessions, because they recur all the time. But I think it's the idea of recurrence that's more interesting to me. You know, the fact that I like to keep it simple in the sense of getting a few, very, very few elements and just making them appear again and again. Like somebody was asking me the other day about suits, men's suits, and why all the people in the book were like wearing the same brand of men's suits. I said I didn't want to bother finding out about men's suits, which is not a field where I'm like really comfortable. So I just made up this Italian-sounding name, and I gave them that brand, you know. Or the fact that everybody's drinking the same drinks all the time, you know. I think they just drink like Macallan whiskey in Finlandia vodka all the time, and so this is very much the way I work, you know. I keep it simple. I just give them one specimen of each category, and they deal with it, the characters, you know. And about largeness or large things, if I understood the question correctly, I wanted this to be a large book, a big novel, you know. And I was also very when I was conceiving the book, I was looking for a specific language for it, you know, as opposed to my previous books. My previous books were more, I guess you could call them more like a formally modern than this one, or postmodern, or more experimental. But I wanted to do something very traditional. I wanted to do something very linear and something very, you know, conservative in many ways. So I was very seduced by the style of Charles Dickens, and he uses this like thing that I don't know how to describe exactly, but I would say it's like comical exaggeration, where everything the language itself is very large, is very pompous, you know, to a comic effect, and this thing that's especially he specially uses in his first novels, I thought I could adapt it to this book. You know, the fact that this language where everything becomes so like detailed and pompous and redundant, that in the end it becomes like a funny rhythm, you know, where you get into, that might be hard to get into in the first chapters, but in the end you're just inside it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm curious about this repetition of phrases, and also, for example, I wanted to ask you about the constant concern for green, and particularly the green. For example, the green eye covering that a couple of characters actually have, which is quite interesting. Just like the shoe, repetitive. But I'm curious, from a translator standpoint, Marafe, I'm curious as to whether you wanted to actually mimic the exact same phrase just as in the native manuscript, that this was essential, or did you consider any time along the way just shifting the phrasing a little bit so it wasn't so repetitive as, or did you, was this not even a distinction?
Well, when I'm working, I try to stick fairly close to the original syntax and grammar because I think it's intrinsic to an author's style. I don't believe that, except for certain obvious things, you know, in Spanish the adjectives go after the noun, usually things like that. But I don't think of it so much as a language thing as a style thing. And then when I read it over, I adapt that because it often comes out awkward. And one of the main things I do is break up sentences because they get too convoluted as to which clause is modifying what. And so sometimes I'll just add a period in there and start fresh. I also sometimes turn things around. If there's a lot of modifying clauses, I'll put one in the beginning instead of having them all follow in succession. Otherwise, I feel that that's an important way to maintain the author's style. So I try to maintain that as much as I can.
I think that this might be maybe too technical and maybe slightly boring, but I think that there is what I could call, I guess, the inner rhythm of Spanish is very different from the inner rhythm of English. So Spanish has like a complication in itself, like a way of not saying things straight away, but just like
beating around the bush
much more, which which can be used sometimes for chemical effect, I think. But we found, or she found, that when you were when you changed that into English, it didn't really work exactly the same. I mean, it did work somehow, but it became not a problem, but just sometimes it wasn't like exactly funny in English. Sometimes it was a little like too much. So we kind of like took a little bit of the repetition out, a little bit of the labyrinth aspect of the prose out, and she kind of like tried to recreate it in English, you know, making those alterations that she was mentioning, because I don't know, I find English a much more simple language and so much more straightforward. So. So I think that it was worth to just try to deconstruct and recreate a little bit instead of just reproducing the style of the original. But I'm saying this, I think this might be too technical and therefore boring.
You can be technical and boring, whatever. We leave the listeners to judge that. But I actually was curious, in light of this, the fact that retranslating the rhythm into another language perhaps was a boring prospect for you. I mean, you've translated David Foster Wallace, so I'm curious if this is why you refrained from translating your own material. You wanted to farm it off to someone else, or you had had enough of looking at this particular book. What happened?
Oh, well, Xavi translates into Spanish.
Yeah. Yes, I know. And as a result, I'm wondering why he didn't, you know, not translating back.
He doesn't translate into English.
Got it.
It's...
Got it.
You know, with novels, it's kind of important to be native in the final language, just for slight bits of nuance and, you know.
Yeah, supposedly you can only translate into your native language. I mean, my English is not that good to translate any English text into Spanish, you know. No, the other way around. Spanish text into English. She does that. I do. English into Spanish.
So to get the precise rhythms, you just have to be a native. Got it.
Okay. Yeah.
I also wanted to actually ask you, just from a thematic standpoint, some have actually compared this to David Foster Wallace, but actually, to me, it actually had a lot of resemblance to Tom Wolfe. And I'm curious, particularly with the character of Pavel, who is clinging to Rastafarian philosophy. But simultaneously, this is also reminiscent of the character in Man in Full, who is clinging to Zeno. And I'm curious if Tom Wolfe was as much influenced perhaps on this, or whether influences were not so particularly prominent. But what happened here?
Well, the way I see it, there is this thing with literary journalism. In journalism in general, which basically they would use your biography, you know, just to evaluate your writing, because it's easier than just to evaluate the writing itself. That's why I have found with the time that just some people say that, you know, they find this connection between you, but for instance, between me and David Foster Wallace, because they know that I had translated his work. But I don't think there is any connection. You know, it's just something that journalists say because they know that there's like a professional connection between these two authors, and it's easier to say it than just to, you know, to go to the book and find the real connection. But anyway, I mean, I've read a very few reviews of the book here in America, and of course. People just associate a text with what they know and what's here in America. Like people have like systematically associated the book with like you know, comic book and graphic novels and Quentin Tarantino. And they, I mean, I have to say that I have never read a graphic novel in my life in its entirety. I don't really watch that much American film, and it was it came to me like a big shock to see that somebody was talking about Quentin Tarantino in relation to my book, because I personally consider this book a much more literary artifact, you know, and more like based on, you know, 19th century fiction and even, I don't know, religion and stuff like that, you know. So I have to say, though, that, I mean, not being American and therefore not having like such a great American literary culture, I don't even know many of the authors that the book is being compared to. Like, I have never read a book by Tom Wolfe. I wouldn't really know if there is a similarity, because I don't know his work at all.
Well, I must ask then, Marafe, if you had read any other books to, I guess, get the idiom right in English for this, because both your translation of this book and your translation of Pandora in the Congo strike me as far more specific in terms of, it's almost as if the translation itself can be placed within a neat kind of genre-specific feel in the prose. And I'm curious if you do it more intuitively or if you actually do, in fact, try to read books surrounding a particular genre or a particular place it might end up so that it might be more palatable to the English ear.
No, I don't do that. I don't think that would be fair to the author. I work with the text, you know, and much more so than with the author, even if he's in the room next door, because they're two separate, very separate things. But the voice I try to pull from the text itself, not from any other text. I obviously if the author is working with references, as in Pandora in the Congo, with, you know, adventure stories and things like that, it should come through in the original. And so I really try to be as faithful to that as I can, to the authors. I think a mistake in translation can be being too, feeling you know more than the author. You know, it's like a trap. You think, oh, I know what he's trying to say here. Which you sometimes have to be able to say, okay, I can make this choice for him, because there's choices to be made, definitely. It's, you know, sometimes the word, there's the perfect word, and sometimes there isn't. You know, this word has, there's no one word that means that in English, and you have to. But I try to avoid anticipating the author.
Yeah. But in this case, what did you do to insulate yourself? Because the author here is in the next room. Did you essentially just go ahead and not really communicate as little or as minimally as possible without ear, or what happened here?
Oh, well, we communicate a lot, but it's often about what we're going to have for lunch, or who's going to go pick up our daughter from school.
But I think that the situation where your wife is your translator and you're like living on the same roof, or your husband is the author you're translating, is a potential nightmare, you know. So I think it was good that she didn't really came to me that much, or I wasn't like bothering her, and we had like some space between us, and because like it's very easy also to like just create a professional distance in a question like that. But yeah, it was good that we didn't try to work together, and she only came to me when she really had like an important question or something like that. Because imagine, I think translating your husband's work might be probably a pretty good cause for a divorce, you know. Potentially.
Yeah. I also wanted to ask you also about the weird issues of masculinity between Saudade and Annabelle. You've got a dichotomy here going on between comic books versus Saudade, whose penis itself is a character, which is quite remarkable. It's almost as if this book, you know, you're talking that this, you were more inspired by 19th century sources.
Yeah.
But simultaneously, I wonder if the masculinity here that is so just exuberant and lively in this, if this came largely from your 19th century inspiration, or if it came from the period or of Barcelona or whatnot.
In the case of these two characters, they both have a clearly pathological approach to sexuality. And what I do normally when I'm planning a book and I'm like creating the characters, is I try to define them psychologically, considering that there is no real distance between psychology and psychopathology. So what I do normally is to create a specific pathology for each character, considering that we are basically all of us somehow pathological in our relationship to others and to ourselves. So what I do is maybe just find the specific syndrome of each character, and I think that the specific set of problems and difficulties, mental difficulties, is what defines the individual. So that's why I just mostly everybody in the book has some like exaggeratedly pathological element, but it's the defining element of that character. But I think that at the same time, that pathology can be a metaphor for like personality types, or and we can like see ourselves reflected in them.
But also, speaking of pathology, there's also something interesting in the fact that you have Lucas putting together the Stephen King novel into other books, and here you have a book that has excerpts of this fictitious Stephen King novel. So I suppose there's almost a metafictional pathology here in place as well. What others? Does this permit you to go larger by, extending the concept of world or broadening the concept of world and having it through these sort of reflective patterns throughout the book? Or just go back to the repetition of a particular descriptive element that you were talking about before?
I wasn't aware of this parallel thing. There was a review in Spain that was when I read it. That was the first time that I noticed that my book had like some inserted parts of a Stephen King novel, and there was a book inside the novel that also had like those inserted parts, which is the book that's like smuggled into the mental institution so the character can read the Stephen King book. I had not noticed until that point that there was this thing about the metafictional thing. I was trying to avoid to do something like complicated or metafictional, but at the same time I wanted the Stephen King novel to be somehow present in the book more than just as an allusion, you know, because I wanted the novel to be like somehow a character too. I'm not interested in like books that talk about other books per se, but I'm very interested to portray how fiction interplays with the mind. So I understand that to be faithful to like a realistic style of novel writing, you have to portray the minds of the characters in constant interplay with the fictions that surround them. So I'm not interested in commenting about like Stephen King in itself, you know. I don't think my book really says anything about Stephen King, but it says a lot about the way, or it tries to say a lot about the way we deal with these fictions, you know, like Stephen King or some of the other, or like the Fantastic Book, four comic books, you know, stuff like that, how they are really influential to people's lives.
There's also the really warped viewpoint of the Louis Armstrong song, where you have Leon say, what Louis Armstrong is saying, like the genius he is that the world is wonderful because the world is horrible. Could it not be argued that your position in writing this book was to depict a wonderfully horrible book, a wonderfully horrible world within a book, that the book or the fiction made the horribleness exciting, enticing, something that was, lively, something that was precisely what this odd view of Louis Armstrong's song is all about?
The thing with the title, which I was asked many times if it was an ironic title, and I said no, it is not. I do not know how to use irony in this way, because irony basically means just saying the opposite of what you think. So that would mean that by putting a book titled Wonderful World and using irony would be to just present the world as a horrible thing. Whereas I think that the book is very optimistic in many ways. You know, if you see the way the characters progress through the book, it is a comedy in the sense that it is basically a happy end for everybody, you know. It's the opposite of a tragedy, you know. The bad guys get punished, like Saudade, and the good guys, they basically get what they want, you know, like Lucas can finally find some like a friendship in the end, you know, and Pavel goes to Jamaica. And so it is kind of like a comedy in that sense. Everything ends well. The thing with the Wonderful World song and the way it is commented is just that, I think it's the Russians in the book who are like listening to the song and explaining. It's just that they have this song which they cannot like really understand the way it was originally conceived, because for them that's stupid. You know, that song belongs to a different world. It belongs to a different era, So now what they do is just they take the, it's like they take the good parts of it, you know, they kind of like make them, they appropriate the song, and they say, well, you know, it's impossible, it's totally impossible that this guy was serious when he was singing this, because it's obviously that the world is not like that. So it has to be that he's talking about us, you know, and the world is wonderful, but it's not wonderful because of, you know, the singing birds and stuff. It's wonderful because we're here and because we can just like change the world and make it, you know, like a place of happiness for ourselves.
This leads me to wonder, since we're talking about expansive worlds, going back to Marafay, I'm curious if you had any particular input on what specific references that had to be changed over to English so that English readers would understand them, or whether any particular long passages were excised. I mean, this is a very particular structure, and I'm wondering if there were any particular battles or any kinds of compromises that had to be reached in keeping it as, I suppose, as self-contained as possible for the English readership.
I think Chavi's work, and Chavi as a person, is very influenced by Anglo-Saxon culture, and the references to Pink Floyd and, you know, the Fantastic Four, those were all in there, and were obviously intelligible. The one thing that we wondered about, but we didn't end up changing, and, you know, the editor at Harper had no problem with it, was some of the football, the soccer references, which are very particular to a team. It's a sort of a Mets team, to make an analogy. The lesser, the underdog team of Barcelona, when that has a real uber dog team as well, and that Saudade is a fan of. But at one point he's even singing, it's an old chant, you know, fight song of that club, which I left just as it is. I didn't even translate it into English. And Chavi and I wondered if how that was going to come across to English-speaking readers, but we ended up just leaving it as it was. I prefer not to do that kind of cultural interpretation. And in some books, it's easier than others. As in, I've just finished a book that is very Spanish and has then characters from Latin America, and they're always making comments about the different vocabulary that they use in Latin America as opposed to in Spain, and things like that that are very difficult to translate. But in other books, as in Pandora, which is not set in a Spanish-speaking country even. Well, it's a Catalan book, not set in a Catalan-speaking country, but between England and Africa. And with this book, it was fairly easy. The only real changes that we made, or that, and I think was lucky for Chavi to have me there, is that he, you know, as in a second edition of a book, he had some changes he wanted to make in the style. And we worked together on it for a while, and then I kind of got the rhythm, and I felt like I was able to continue it throughout the rest of the book. But the references, I don't think there was anything. Sometimes, but I don't like to put footnotes, so sometimes I'll add a clause that sort of explains something if I feel it needs that. But I don't know that I did that with this book.
Yeah, footnotes are horrible. There's always the temptation of like cultural adaptation,
you know,
when you're translating. And
so I think I answered that question.
Actually, a question to Chavi. I have to ask you, in light of the Donald Duck character and the fact that Sadade, I mean, ends up, you know, I don't want to reveal it, but it really is a terrible fate. I must ask you about the cruelty to these characters. I mean, you know, this is a question that is often posed to T.C. Boyle, because he's likewise very fond of flinging his characters around like some wicked god. And in this case, you do that with all of the people who, Bocanegra, all of his crew, a good chunk of them go through these really, really terrible fates. And I'm curious about this in light of your previous answer concerning about how this is a positive book. I mean, it's certainly fun, but there's a lot of really grisly stuff here.
Yeah, I guess you're right. I'm embarrassed to say that you're probably right. I wasn't trying to shock by writing that, but I thought that at the same time, how could I explain this? It's hard for me to explain. I'll just say that I think that humor is something that evolves continually, and the way that you now can read like a comedy written in the 1940s, for instance, and you see all that humor, and it's like fossils of humor, you know, it's like ruins of jokes. And you know that they used to be funny, but they're not anymore. So now you're running in the 21st century, so you have to keep pushing the humor. So you need to make it sometimes very extreme. You know, you need to like just hint at something horrible that's going to happen to a character. It's going to be tortured, and then just finish the chapter. And you know that's fun. That's funny somehow because the reader is just imagining these horrible things happening, you know. And it's kind of cruel, but I think that's the way to make people laugh these days, you know. Otherwise, you're just going back to those like fossils and ruins of jokes. People now are kind of, we're very corrupted by the wickedness of, you know, of the... How would you explain this?
Well, of both society and our cultural influences. I mean, people who watch 24, you know, this torture is nothing to them, you know. But we have a friend who is a writer in Catalan. We've actually never met him, but he's a friend on Facebook. And he's always posting things about, like, you know, how reality has caught up with me again, because he writes these fantastical, you know, things, and the world constantly, you know, one-ups him. So yeah. I think that there's a truth to that.
Vocationally speaking, you know, would you say that this is a scenario that both of you are facing, constantly having to, I guess, up the game here? And is there a risk in losing a little bit of subtlety in both of your respective crafts?
I know what you mean, and I've been concerned with that question for some time now, the question of subtlety. I think that subtlety is something to be desired, but it's also something to be avoided, because I think that I find extremity very, very seductive in general, you know, and excess in many ways. And I think that when you're an artist, and you always have to be like one step ahead of the people, of just the readers, you know, just in order to surprise them and to get their interest. So you have to think of things that maybe are a little extreme, but they will not be extreme in a few years, you know. I don't know if I'm explaining myself correctly. So it's just I try to not be subtle at all. You know, I try to always be a little aggressive in my findings, a little, you know, because I think this is the way also to choose. You know, you're working in a tradition, and you have to push it forward. You know, you have to, and sometimes being subtle means making conservative choices.
Well, I would argue actually that there is some subtlety in this book. For example, Lucas and Valentina both do not have fathers, and they both have wacky mothers. It's a kind of parallelism that I'm wondering if you intended or didn't intend. Even if you didn't intend it, it still offers a subtlety to balance off the more gargantuan aspects of your novel. So what of do parallels, is this a way for you to kind of create the subtlety, or is that more attempting a framework with which to collect all these various ideas?
They have parallel lives. That's why they're friends. I mean, they're the say it again, Mara. The el club de la gente que no tiene madre, no tiene padre.
Oh, the Down with the Sun Society.
No.
Yeah. Oh, the club of people who have no mother and no father.
Yeah, that's what gets them together in the first place. But that's just because that's what the book is about. The book ultimately is about fatherless people and childless people looking for their fathers and looking for their children. You know, this is a book about an absence, you know, about the absence in your life, in your family life, that determines all the things that you're going to do, right?
Well, there's one last question I want to ask you about in relation to art. You have this painting, The Somnambulist in the Ambulance, and Iris sees it as nothing more than an abstract composition of colorful splotches. This is interesting in light of the fact that you also have Stephen King in this book, perhaps the most well-known, popular book that would be imaginable, that is also, you know, accepted to varying degrees by certain literary people. So I'm curious if really this reference to stealing art, this reference to having excerpts of art within this book, is a way of essentially commenting upon this problem of whether art actually reflects a world or not, or whether the world reflects art. What of this artistic concern in this book?
Okay, that is a very big and complex question. With Stephen King, I knew exactly what I wanted to do with the Stephen King reference. I wanted to have some form of art that was completely popular, that was all over the place, so that everybody could understand. You know, also that I could like kind of replicate the. I don't know exactly how the Stephen King parts work in the book, but the Spanish version was trying to recreate the language of the Spanish translations of Stephen King books, which is because I think that is kind of like a universal language. You know, everybody knows Stephen King, and I wrote this thing in the acknowledgement section. What I say, made this humble book be a homage to the most enduring genius of our time, because I thought that that there is something amazingly enduring about Stephen King. I think that even archaeologically speaking, in 2,000 years, there will be like just one book, one 21st century book in a museum, and it will be Stephen King's, you know, because everything else will probably be forgotten except for him, you know, because he's everywhere. So I wanted to create like a universal language so everybody could understand what the characters in the book are going through. The other artistic references are they work in a completely different way. This is very hard for me to explain in English, but there is one main reference, which is the a series of paintings that's based on the Book of Revelation. And this this series of paintings revolve about the metaphor, the symbol, the artistic symbol of the Black Sun. The Black Sun is an apocalyptic symbol, but it is also present in like hermeticism and magic. So if you notice the character Lucas, he works with art. He's like an art dealer, but he's not really like interested in art. It's not something that you can see in his mind, but he knows that those paintings have some sort of power, and that power, which is like a power based on like mystery maybe because they're like totally unintelligible and they're like very dark, but they have been like prohibidos,
banned
for parts of history and everything. But in those paintings, because they're hermetic, people can see themselves reflected in a way, because they're kind of like empty surfaces. And same thing with the Somnambulist in Anambulus, which is an entirely different reference. I could explain, but it would take a long time. But because his own father had felt the same, he knows that these paintings are the vehicle to access his father's mind, you know? So this is an idea of art as just a recipient for emotions and for the person's mind that can just like reach other worlds through these like hermetic surfaces. I don't know if I could actually manage to explain myself. You know, the same way that Lucas's father is, he's an agoraphobic and a photophobic, and his son replicates those illnesses, you know, throughout the book, and he starts like being afraid of windows and being afraid of like open spaces just the same, you know, because in a way this is how we kind of define ourselves is by imitating our fathers, you know, metaphorically speaking. There's also like a religious element in this because, of course, the quest for the absent father is the main theme of Christianity, you know.
But also, Annabelle has this tendency to cross his arms, and he has such a belly that he has to do it like this, essentially. So I'm wondering if this is kind of the anti-Christ-like sort of gesture with the arms crossing like that.
In composition.
Because Christ is crucified like this,
yeah.
And then Annabelle is like this, and he has to do it very close. Actually, he's supposed to cross like this, but you happen to have a big belly, so he ends up having to do it like this, and it's almost in the exact same position.
I wasn't aware of that, but I think that's good, yeah.
Okay. Well, very good. Well, thank you very much, Javier and Marafe. It was a pleasure chatting with you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about a science book. Don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I love you. And I know that if you love me too, what a wonderful world this would be. Don't know much about geography. Don't know much trigonometry. Don't know much about algebra. Don't know what a slide rule.